From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Vice President Gore chooses Senator Lieberman as his vice presidential running mate. Also, we'll look at the human casualties of the big funders of the Republican Party. That's the National Rifle Association and Big Tobacco. And finally, a look at the war in Chechnya. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Al Gore has made his choice. The vice president will round out the Democratic presidential ticket with Joseph Lieberman. The Connecticut senator would become the first Jewish vice presidential candidate in American history. Several party sources say Gore plans to offer Lieberman the position in a phone call later today, and Lieberman has suggested he will accept. Both men will then appear together at a midday rally tomorrow in Tennessee as Gore makes his choice public. The decision came after Gore met last night with top advisors. Senator Lieberman is considered a centrist within the party. He also was an outspoken critic of President Clinton's conduct during last year's impeachment controversy. Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness and three other American demonstrators camped outside Baghdad's UN compound, saying they won't eat for 3 days to protest the effects of 10 years of crippling international sanctions on Iraq. The protests are to draw attention to the plight of Iraqis under the sanctions, which bar the country from trading with the rest of the world, except through a limited United Nations sanctioned loophole. The UN imposed the sanctions 4 days after Iraq's 1990 invasion of Kuwait, which led to the Persian Gulf War. The U.S. government has been the chief backer, saying the sanctions must remain in place until Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein has proven to UN inspectors he's given up his weapons of mass destruction. In Washington, hundreds of people, including Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader and folk singer Pete Seeger, ended a day of marches and rallies yesterday with a protest in Lafayette Park across the street from the White House. In Amman, Jordan, more than 200 activists called for the sanctions to be lifted during a rally outside UN offices. They handed over a letter at the office addressed to Kofi Annan that urged the UN Secretary General to, quote, side with justice and humanity and get the sanctions lifted. Iraq held no official commemoration of the anniversary, but a government newspaper yesterday called on the international community to, quote, participate in destroying the sanctions wall. Russian officials said yesterday that scores of rebels were killed in artillery strikes outside the capital, Grozny, as Russian soldiers were on high alert after warnings of a possible rebel offensive. The bodies of 22 dead militants were found at the scene of the strikes, the village of Petropavlovsk, in northeast of Grozny. The report came as Russian soldiers were put on high alert in their fortified defenses in Grozny. Russian forces have been warning for days that rebels may be planning a new offensive, which marks the anniversary of the day in 1996 that the insurgents retook Grozny from Russian troops in the previous Chechen War. It began a counteroffensive that forced Russia's withdrawal. Negotiations are to resume this morning between Verizon Communications and two unions trying to agree on a new contract for more than 87,000 workers. Employees at the nation's largest local telephone company walked off their jobs early Sunday. Bargainers worked until 1 a.m. Eastern time today before recessing for the night. Both sides report substantial progress on a pact, though they add that major issues remain unresolved. With managers filling in for striking workers, company officials hope for a quick resolution to get workers back on the job with the start of the work week. No disruptions in basic services have been reported, but there have been some delays for directory assistance callers. The dispute affects Verizon operations in 12 eastern states from Maine to Virginia. Some 2,000 farm workers called for better wages and working conditions during a 4.5-mile march between two south central farm towns in Washington state. The demonstrators want higher apple-picking wages, amnesty for undocumented workers, and protection for labor organizers from reprisals by employers. In February, the AFL-CIO Executive Council passed a resolution calling for federal legislation granting amnesty to the 6 million undocumented workers in the United States. Most of Washington State's more than 100,000 agricultural workers are undocumented. About 5,000 Puerto Ricans rallied in San Juan yesterday to protest the latest round of U.S. military exercises on the outlying island of Vieques. They marched to the gates of a suburban army base where organizers urged them to double their efforts to force the Navy out. And this news from Mexico. Tensions escalated yesterday in Paraiso, the village sympathetic to Zapatista rebels in the southern state of Chiapas, as paramilitaries patrolled streets only days after burning down homes and sending scared residents fleeing. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today, broadcasting from New York is coming back from the week-long extended coverage we brought you from Philadelphia with the Republican National Convention. And next week, we'll be in Los Angeles for a similar kind of comprehensive coverage that will be broadcast on public access television and radio throughout next week. We also encourage you to go to our website, unveiled for the elections, called Breaking with Convention, Power, Protest, and the Presidency. That's at www.democracynow.org. And speaking of protests, there were major protests in Washington this weekend on the 10th anniversary of the bombing of the sanctions being imposed against Iraq. As we said in the headlines, Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness and three other American demonstrators camped outside Baghdad's UN compound, saying they won't eat for 3 days to protest the effects of 10 years of crippling international sanctions on Iraq. One of the people who participated in the United States in the protests was Rania Masri, who is with Iraq Action Coalition. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Rania Masri.
Thank you.
Can you tell us about this weekend's protests and the significance of this weekend, 10 years after the sanctions, also the anniversary of the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima?
It's a quite devastating anniversary. Many of us never thought this day would come, that sanctions against Iraq would still be imposed 10 years after first August 6, 1990. We spent this weekend in two parts. We spent Saturday primarily on educational efforts, distribution of information among ourselves. And it was deeply empowering and encouraging to see a wide range of people present and to see a wide range of speakers, from a survivor of Hiroshima to a survivor of the Iraq sanctions and Iraqi doctor to a veteran, all sitting there side by side, all saying the same thing, bombing on Iraq.
I just want to say, Rania, you are cutting out a little bit. You're on a cell phone, and are you on a train?
No, I'm sitting completely still trying to give you a clear signal.
Okay, keep going.
Okay, I was just saying that it was quite encouraging to see a Hiroshima survivor and a
Having trouble here. Can you repeat just your last sentence?
Yes, there was a Hiroshima survivor, an Iraqi doctor, and a Gulf War veteran standing side by side on Saturday during one of the teach-ins, all explaining how the sanctions and the bombing have caused suffering to both the Iraqis and the Americans.
And these 10 years of sanctions, what are the figures that the Iraq Action Coalition, the United Nations, have calculated at this point for casualties in Iraq?
Well, UNICEF conducted a countrywide study in August of 1999, and they stated that had the sanctions not been imposed and had Iraqi situations continued as they were before the sanctions, then 500,000 children under the age of 5 would be alive today with their parents. So in other words, the sanctions themselves have killed 500,000 children under the age of 5. If we're going to take that and estimate how many children over the age of 5 and how many adults and how many elderly people have been killed as a consequence of the sanctions, then we can safely say that there have been 1 million Iraqis killed as a direct consequence of the UN-US sanctions.
Rania Masri, can you tell us about Kathy Kelly, as well as the three other protesters in Baghdad, as you were in Washington, D.C., outside of the White House?
Well, Kathy Kelly and a few other Americans left Chicago approximately a month ago, and they're spending 2 months in Basra. And in their first press release, they said, yes, it is true, we are melting from the heat because it is approximately 50 degrees Celsius in Basra. But they also said that they are melting from the Iraqi hospitality and the warmth and generosity that they are finding around them, even though the people that they are staying with have barely enough food, definitely don't have any medicine, are in extreme, extreme poverty. And this is all an artificial state of poverty imposed by the United Nations. This is not a natural state of poverty. And they are there to both as witness to the suffering the Iraqis are going through, and instead of simply going for a week, they want to go for 2 months to truly experience what it is like to be in Iraq.
The plans for this week, the protests yesterday, Ralph Nader was also there, Green Party presidential candidate, and hundreds of other people. What about today?
Well, let me tell you a little bit more about yesterday. In addition to Ralph Nader, Representative Kucinich was there, and it was quite important to see a congressional representative and a presidential candidate saying the same thing. And Representative Kucinich stated that he is committed to continue working to ending the sanctions. And it would be quite a wonderful day when we hear the other hundreds of U.S. congressional representatives saying the same thing. We were approximately 1,000 people in pouring rain across from the White House, expressing our solidarity with the people of Iraq. Today, the Fellowship of Reconciliation and the American Friends Service Committee is doing something called a campaign of conscience, where they are trying to send equipment to cleanse Iraqi water. This is banned equipment, and they are trying to send it, and they will commit acts of civil disobedience by in so doing. And it's going to start. It started approximately 12 minutes ago, and at 10 o'clock is when they're going to commit their acts of civil disobedience. So we will know in a few hours exactly what will happen today.
Finally, do the Republicans and Democrats at all differ with each other around the issue of sanctions against Iraq?
On a political party basis, no. They seem to both agree that sanctions against Iraq should continue, even though the objectives are nebulous. The weapons of mass destruction have been destroyed, and the Iraqi people are being killed. What is important is that, like I said, we do have a presidential candidate who is expressing words of conscience. We do have representatives in Congress who are opposed to this policy, but it is not a partisan division. They are simply a few good men and women of Democratic and Republican background who are not siding with their party, but siding with their conscience. But on a political party platform, both the Republicans and the Democrats, that are in all sense the same party, are united in their continuation of the war against Iraq.
Rania Masri, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Rania Masri of the Iraq Action Coalition. I did get a chance to ask former President Bush how he felt about those who called him war criminal, for the bombing of Iraq, and he said they are idiots. Well, we're going to continue on the theme of militarism right now, moving to guns. You may remember that a top National Rifle Association official was caught on videotape saying that if George W. Bush was elected, the NRA wouldn't just have access to the White House. They would be operating out of the Oval Office. Well, at the Republican National Convention last week, there were thousands of shoes nearby. That's right, an independent mall. About 19,000 shoes were lined up, all of victims of gun violence. I sat in Independence Mall with Ellen Freudenheim, who is the co-founder of the organization called Silent March, and I asked her to describe what we were doing. Tell us about these shoes. How many are there?
We have approximately 18,000 pairs of shoes here. We wanted to show the gun death toll of 19-year-olds and under, youth of 19-year-olds and under, in the last 4 years. That's 17,822. This is how many kids have been killed by guns since the last presidential election. And I'm sorry to say this is how many kids will be killed by guns in the next 4 years if we don't do something to change it in this presidential election.
What is your story? How did you get involved with this issue?
I'm actually not a victim of gun violence, but I live in New York City, and there was a homicide in Prospect Park in 1993 near my home, and I suddenly came to the realization that this is a problem that can happen to anybody, that gun violence, while not totally random, cuts across race, class, geography, gender, and that's probably somebody could do something about it. What I didn't realize in 1993 is how difficult it is to do something about gun violence. And that's because we all need to participate in this activity of telling elected officials that we want prevention, not just criminal justice solutions, but prevention solutions.
Are these actually the shoes of people who have died?
Many of these shoes are the actual shoes of people who have died. Some are sent in memory and some are sent in protest. And all of the shoes were sent by one person. We asked that only one pair of shoes be sent by someone. So whether the shoes were sent as this pair I'm looking at by someone who... Jonathan died at age 17, killed by an unknown assailant. Whether these are size 15 shoes or they're little baby shoes that were sent presumably with no note in them by someone who didn't want their child to end up that way, the sender had a thought when they sent these pair of shoes.
In the past week, we have heard George W. Bush announce that Dick Cheney would be his running mate. Dick Cheney's record on guns, he was against a ban on cop killer bullets, against even a ban on plastic guns that even the NRA did not oppose that could get through airport security. What is your reaction to this choice and overall to the Republican ticket and Bush and Cheney's record?
Well, in Texas, Governor Bush enabled people to carry concealed weapons into churches. And you just described Mr. Cheney's record. So the message overall is that we need prevention, and this does not strike me as good prevention. We need people who will understand that by regulating firearms like other consumer products, we're not violating the Second Amendment or right to bear arms or anything of that sort.
What do you hope to accomplish with Silent March?
We want to wake people up to the fact that this is an epidemic and that there are so many thousands of kids getting killed as well as adults every year, and that this is preventable. And we would like to educate the public to the fact that very small changes can save a lot of lives. Trigger locks, load indicators, gun show loophole closures, very small and very modest measures without ever offending the Second Amendment, without even talking about the Second Amendment. And we need to pressure the people in Congress to do that, or we need a new regulatory agency that will regulate the safety of firearms the way we regulate the safety of automobiles, pharmaceuticals, foodstuffs.
Who's winning, you or the NRA?
Well, that's a very complicated question. I think since I've been involved in this in 1993, there are many, 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 by many times magnitude, more people involved. There's much greater public awareness. I don't know who's winning right now, but I'm sure we will win because this is insupportable. This evidence of an epidemic that we're sitting amongst right now is insupportable. And I've seen personally an enormous growth in public awareness and participation. So sooner or later, these guns will be regulated, and we'll look back at this as some period of American history that was tragic, foolish, and preventable.
How much money is the NRA pouring into the Republican and Democratic parties?
I don't have the exact figures, but it's in the millions, and it has not yet been matched by the quote-unquote gun control movement. But money aside, I think what we're after here is the understanding and therefore the votes of the American people. I don't really believe that you can buy votes, and I do think that politicians are watching this issue very carefully this year to see, maybe not at the presidential level, but in certain local elections, to see how much of a single voting block the gun control community will be. We've had an unprecedented year since Columbine. You know, white middle class America woke up to the fact that this is an issue that affects everybody. And soon after that, the Million Mile March was an unprecedented mobilization. Nobody expected either of those things to turn out the way they did. Nobody really knows how this is going to play in the election. And I would posit that Americans are sick and tired of gun violence and will vote that issue.
Is the silent march headed to the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles?
You bet. We will be there. We will show how many kids will be killed by guns if we don't do something about this. And we will not only be there, but we'll be at the first presidential debate in Boston.
One more time, how many children have been killed by guns since the last presidential election?
17,822 youth, age 19 and under, were killed by guns since the last presidential election. It's a lot of kids.
Ellen Freudenheim, if people want to get in touch with the Silent March, is there a phone number or a place they can go on the web?
The website is www.silentmarch.org, and the phone is 516-247-9101.
Ellen Freudenheim speaking to us on Independence Mall in Philadelphia at the Republican National Convention.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Again, the specifics on that comment of a top-level NRA official about George W. Bush. It was first Vice President Kane Robinson, who is in line to succeed NRA President Charlton Heston, added that the NRA enjoys, quote, unbelievably friendly relations with the Texas governor. Robinson, who's also chair of the Iowa Republican Party, made the comments February 17th before 300 members in Los Angeles. He also described 2000 as a critical election in which Bush's success would ensure, quote, a Supreme Court that will back us to the hilt. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, other human casualties of the big funders of the Republican Party. We're going to look at big tobacco. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Over the past week on Democracy Now!, we have reported extensively on the big money that flowed through Philadelphia during the Republican National Convention. Among the biggest contributors to the Republican coronation was cigarette giant Philip Morris. It pumped in more than $250,000 for the gala alone, while doling out $1.5 million for the Republican Party. But Philip Morris is a bipartisan contributor. It's also pouring money into the Democratic Convention, which begins 1 week from today. Already this year, it's given the Democrats around $250,000. Well, today we're going to look at one of the victims of big tobacco. It's the story of Frank Amadeo. He was one of the lead plaintiffs in the landmark decision against big tobacco a few weeks ago. Cigarette companies were ordered to pay $145 billion. Ripley's, believe it or not, has him listed as the longest surviving non-comatose person to have not eaten or drank anything via his mouth. The last time he ate or drank was June 12, 1988. Since then, he's been fed through a tube in his stomach. He takes nothing in through his mouth. His tongue is bone dry, so dry, in fact, that when he recently testified before the jury in that precedent-setting case for 3.5 days, his wife had to moisten his tongue with her finger dipped in water as he would testify on the stand. Her finger was sliced from his razor-sharp tongue. He was in our studios a week ago, just after the decision, a couple weeks ago. And he talked about the significance of the decision. But today, we'll hear his human story. We have been covering the record-setting $145 billion verdict in the class action smoking case in Florida. We've also spoken with one of our guests already, but there we were talking about the legal implications of the decision and also the future of the tobacco industry. Now I wanted to just bring you more the human story of one of the lead plaintiffs in this case, Frank Amadeo. Also joining us is Frank Amadeo's wife, Margaret, because this story is certainly a family story as well. For a person who has survived throat cancer to make it, it takes a village, if probably is fair to say. Well, it took Margaret, I think, clearly a partner in this case. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
My pleasure to be here.
Well, can you tell us first when you started smoking?
I started smoking in the early 50s when there weren't any warnings at all on any cigarette packs. None.
What did you smoke?
I started with I smoked anything, but my main brands were in the beginning Lucky's and Campbell's.
And when did you start to get a sense that smoking might not be good for you?
A sense?
You have some idea. That's
smart. Well, you know, I mean, that's a two-part question. For example, anyone who smoked eventually 12 years, 13 years after I started smoking, everybody saw the warnings. You know, you'd have to live on another planet if you were a smoker and you didn't see the warnings, so I did. And of course, on the same thing, I also heard some of the statements made by the public health that smoking may be hazardous to your health. But on the flip side of that coin, I would also hear people from the tobacco industry saying, look, there's no scientific proof smoking causes cancer or any other disease. And what we're going to do is spend millions of dollars in scientific research. And if we find out there's something wrong with our product, we're going to let the American public know because that's the most important thing to us. So what they did, the tobacco companies back then, it's created controversy when they really knew the truth. So, when I saw the warnings, and in hindsight, I know I was physically addicted by that time when the warnings came out because I had been smoking about 13 years. It was simply easier for me to believe exactly what the tobacco industry wanted me to believe. Not only me, but millions of other people.
Margaret Amadeo, did you ever smoke?
Yes, I did.
When did you start smoking?
I was about 16.
Mm-hmm. How long did you smoke for?
30 years.
Really?
And yes.
Have you gotten sick?
No, I'm one of the fortunate ones. I have not gotten sick. But today I sound like it. I've got laryngitis.
And I'm the one that's supposed to have the bad throat.
Well, how did you get involved with this lawsuit?
Actually, what happened was I saw an article in the Orlando Sentinel Star.
Were you sick yet?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, I was sick. I was sick and I was mad. And I read about an attorney team, a husband and wife team in Miami, Florida, Stanley and Susan Rosenblatt, who were filing a class action suit against the tobacco industry. So I actually picked up the phone and called information to get their phone number. And I didn't talk to Mr. or Mrs. Rosenblatt. I talked to one of their secretaries. They told me to send out my medical records, which I did. And that's how, and then I heard back from them, and that's how I joined the suit. The Rosenblatts didn't seek me out. I sought them out.
Hmm. When did you get sick?
In 1987, I hemorrhaged from my throat. And that was my birthday. The last thing I ever had to eat in my life was a piece of my birthday cake. And then I hemorrhaged, and the cake came out with a mouthful of blood all over my shirt, all over the room. And they rushed me to the hospital. And I was diagnosed and given approximately 2 weeks to 2 months to live because the tumor was so big that they'd have to shrink it with radiation before they could operate. And I had a pair of wonderful, wonderful, great doctors who performed the treatments on me, along with a lot of prayers by a lot of people. And the radiation treatments, which I had two a day for 35 days. Miraculously, the radiation treatment cured my cancer, but the cancer killed my throat.
So how do you eat then? How do you drink?
I eat and drink through a tube that's been inserted. Well, for the first half year, it was inserted in my nose to my stomach. And then that was removed because it looked so terrible. And then they put the tube in my stomach. And that's how I take all my nourishment through a tube in my stomach.
How does that work?
Well, actually, I use my wife. I need my wife again. We've been married 40 years now, and I don't know how she's put up with it for the last 12 or 13. But she actually has to. It's like a baby. I'm like a baby, you know, half a man. Every time I get hungry, I have a button, permanent button tube inserted into my stomach. She takes another tube, inserts it into the hole in my stomach, and then we use a 60cc syringe where she pours the nourishment and also water. And if I need medicine, she has to crush up the medicine, and that goes to the tube, into my stomach.
Do you get thirsty?
Oh, I'm always thirsty. So, I mean, I'm thirsty now. I'll be thirsty tomorrow. And sometimes you can almost reach your breaking point. The thirst is actually worse than the hunger.
And it's not, the thirst isn't quenched by putting it through the tube in your stomach?
Absolutely not. Not even, there is no clenching of my thirst. It's unclenchable. Have you ever heard the saying, sometimes you feel like you're dying of thirst? True.
We're talking to Frank and Margaret Amadeo, and they are participants in the class action suit that led to the unprecedented $145 billion verdict in their favor. Margaret, how have you held up all of these years?
I've held up fine. I feel very bad for Frank. As he explained, the thirst is unexplainable, but to live this life is horrible. And one thing with the feeding, everybody's heard he gets fed through the stomach. What they don't realize is he's only had a milk-like product. It's not like I can crush spaghetti or something of that sort. Frank has had a nourishment which is similar to baby formula, and that is the only nourishment basically he takes. And we want Frank alive, so me and my children do everything we can to make sure it stays that way.
How many kids do you have?
We have four, three boys and a girl.
So tell me about the trial. Here we have you after the verdict. How long did this trial take?
Margaret and I started attending court every day. From the first day of jury selection, which would have been 2 years, 2 years ago. Well, it started the first week in July, 1998, and we have yet to miss one day of jury selection or trial testimony in the whole case.
This took place in Miami?
It took place in Miami, and we live in Orlando.
And what has your relationship been with the cigarette industry? We're talking Philip Morris, Lorillard, R.J. Reynolds Tobacco, Brown & Williamson, Liggett Group.
There's been no relationship. We see them every day in court. They're the attorneys for the companies. And we did see the executives in the last few weeks, the CEOs. But there has been no relationship at all with them.
Mm-hmm. When they raised the issue of you couldn't prove that your throat cancer had anything to do with smoking, in fact, they said that the wood chips in your workplace, because you make what, cedar clocks?
Cypress clocks.
That it could just as easily have been the wood chips.
Well, when you compare cypress wood to a history of 34 years of smoking a pack and a half to two packs a day, and to me, it was laughable at that point, at this point. Had this been said to me 10 years ago, 1989, 1990, I would have said, well, maybe it would have been. Maybe it was saccharin. Maybe it was pollution. Maybe it was a strain I had on my voice when I was a singer back in the doo-wop days of the 50s. It could have been lots of reasons. And I heard that all the way up until 1994, during the Waxman's congressional hearings, when I saw the CEO stand up in front of Congress, raise their hand, and say smoking's not addictive?
And
I still wasn't sure. It wasn't until after that point in time, when the secret documents came out that I've seen and read for over 2 years. Yeah, we sat there 2 years and we learned a lot more. Statements made by Mr. LeBeau, who was the CEO of Liggett, the whistleblower came out with the secret documents. I read it and I found out they lied for all these years. They knew what was in these things, yet they converted. They started a controversy and they were denying it, yet they knew.
That they deliberately provoked a controversy by the tobacco industry putting out information that the cigarette smoking did not cause cancer,
right.
Just so that every time it was raised, you would always have that sort of reasonable doubt there.
No matter what plaintiff gets up there, they're going to say, yeah, sure, now there's a risk factor, but didn't cause cancer in this person.
What do you think of someone like LeBeau, who the Liggett Group sort of broke ranks with the others? Did he, in some way, was he a whistleblower or not?
Well, Mr. LeBeau, from what I know very little of, except when I heard him in the courtroom testify, for whatever reason he did what he did make a small step in the right direction by not advertising. Because if you don't advertise, you can't advertise to kids. And if you voluntarily put on your package that smoking is addictive, that's also voluntary. That's also a step in the right direction. But that does not excuse, does absolutely 100% does not excuse the conduct they had in the past, that the Liggett Company had since 1950 and on.
We're talking to Frank and Margaret Amadeo, just came out of this $145 billion verdict. Is this something you can get your mind around, $145 billion? What will it mean for you?
It means to me justice. Justice. Message has been sent. A message has been sent, and it's been heard around the world that we're not going to tolerate. The American people are not going to tolerate anymore that corporations, any corporation, can run a business this way, the way they've operated. The industry can run their whole last 50 years through deceit and fraud and conspiracy.
Has this experience changed your view of the world?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I've learned through Mr. Rosenblatt and his wife, Susan, who are absolutely brilliant. Brilliant, the two most brilliant people I've ever met. Not only are they brilliant, they're good people, which to me is more important than brilliant. And we've sat there, like the jury, for over 2 years and listened to the evidence. And that's why I think the verdict that came in with the amount of money is just. I only wish every person in America could have had the opportunity to sit in that courtroom for two full years and listen to the evidence. And if they did, very few would say that verdict was unjust.
And how many people would divide up this settlement?
I have no idea. I have no
idea.
It's
a class action.
It's a class action.
Does that mean
hundreds of thousands? Hundreds of thousands.
Huh. In your case, the jury awarded you in April, is that right, in April, $4 or $5 million?
Something.
A separate lawsuit?
Yeah, it was compensatory damages.
But then it was set aside. Can you explain what was the reasoning for setting it aside, even if you can't go into the case now? What was given? Why would yours be set aside and the others weren't?
I really, on this one, seeing that situation is right now, right today, in the hands of the court, it would be inappropriate for me to make any comment on that at all.
Margaret Amadeo, how has this changed you, this whole experience? Frank's getting cancer, the trial, sitting through 2 years of the American judicial system.
I would say it has taught me a lot. And one thing that has happened is when I look at people today and those plaintiffs and those class members in that courtroom, my heart goes out to them, and I hope I can be as good as some of those spouses are also. They're with their partners. Their partners are in deep pain, things they'll never do again in their whole life. And I hope it makes me a better person.
Margaret and Frank Amadeo as they deal with the consequences of smoking. Frank Amadeo, one of the plaintiffs in the $145 billion successful lawsuit against the cigarette industry. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by someone who'll tell us about hundreds of people about to be arrested at the Treasury Department in Washington. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we go right now live to Washington with Danny Muller of Voices in the Wilderness. Danny, can you tell us what's happening?
Yes, we're just at the Treasury Department annex, and we're on our way towards the White House where people are about to engage in civil disobedience. The Treasury Department just refused to arrest the thousands of people who have signed on to the Campaign of Conscience, which buys supplies to bring to Iraq. And also, they've refused to arrest the people who have been to Iraq, who have broken the sanctions by bringing food and medicine in. And it is the Treasury Department that has threatened them with 12 years in prison and $1 million in fines. Those people have gone here to say, do this, arrest us, because we cannot stand by while children die. And the Treasury Department has refused to do that. Now over 200 people are planning on committing civil disobedience outside the White House to call Clinton and Gore to end sanctions now. Our message is, if you won't end sanctions, we will. We're calling all American people to break the sanctions on Iraq through nonviolent direct action.
Danny Muller, I want to thank you for being with us. As we listen to the chants, what are people chanting?
Lift the sanctions now. We just had been chanting for a couple of minutes, arrest them. People had climbed up onto the steps of the Treasury Department demanding an arrest. Hundreds of people chanting, please arrest these people. People feel so distraught over what's happening that there's a necessity of action that needs to occur to prevent over 5,000 children a month from starving, from dying from simple waterborne diseases that are a direct result from the U.S. imposed sanctions on Iraq.
Danny Muller of Voices in the Wilderness in front of the Treasury Department in Washington will bring you more on that story tomorrow. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Russian officials said yesterday that scores of rebels were killed in artillery strikes outside the capital of Grozny, as Russian soldiers were on high alert after warnings of a possible rebel offensive. The bodies of 22 dead rebels were found at the scene of the strikes. Today we're going to take a look at what's been going on in Chechnya with a young French reporter who just 2 weeks ago won the Albert Londres Prize. It's the highest prize in journalism in France. She came into our studio just a day before the prize was announced. Our guest is Anne Nivat. You may not know her name now, but I think it's going to become a big name when her book gets published. It was published in France, Chien de Guerre. It means, well, how would you translate it?
I would translate it in English like a hell of a war or a bitch of a war, which is even stronger.
And the war you're talking about is?
It's Chechnya.
So tell us your story, how you ended up in Chechnya, a French freelance journalist.
Yeah, I'm based in Moscow. My home is Moscow. I live in Moscow. My dream as a teenager has always been to be a correspondent in Moscow. That's for many reasons, but both of my parents are professors of Russian literature, so I speak Russian better than English, and I feel good in Russia, so now I'm a journalist. So here I am, based in Moscow, and there is a war in the air. I mean, the war started officially October 1st, last year, 1999, and I am in Moscow. So why not go there? I mean, it's easy. You just have to take a plane, basically. You just have to have the will. You take a plane, you go to the neighboring country, which is the little tiny republic of Ingushetia, and because there is no airport in Chechnya available for the public. And then you manage to cross the border, quite difficult, actually. And then you do your job. You report. You file your story. So I was a freelancer at that time. I was filing for the top French daily, Libération, and also a regional French daily, West France, and also an American weekly magazine, U.S. News and World Report. And so the thing is that I was already there when the war started. So that's why I can really say that I was the first one to be there. But the problem is not to be the first or not to be the first. The problem is to be able to file your stories or not to be able to. And a war, this war is quite a dirty and nasty war. And, of course, there are two parties, you know, the Russians on the first hand and the Chechens, the rebels, on the second hand. The Russian authorities, the Kremlin, and they don't want, of course, any witnesses on the spot. They don't want journalists, in other words. They don't want anyone that they could not control. The Chechens, the rebels, they don't really care. They cannot control journalists anyway. It's impossible because the rebels says there are too few of them. I mean, we are talking 90,000 Russian soldiers, Russian forces there in Chechnya against maybe 2,000, 3,000, okay, maybe even 5,000, 6,000 rebels. That's it. And in the middle of that, caught in between, hostages, 400,000 civilians, Chechens, people with whom I shared 6 months of my life because I stayed there for 6 months between September last year until mid-February this year, when actually I was caught by the Russian secret services, the so-called FSB, and they forced me, they obliged me to leave Chechnya, to go back to Moscow.
How did you go into Chechnya? I mean, what did people identify you as, know you as? Did they know you were a reporter?
Yeah. I would never hide the fact that I'm a reporter. When I was talking to people, when I was interviewing them, when I was trying to understand the situation, I would never hide that I'm a reporter. But my physical appearance helped me a great deal. The fact that I'm a woman basically helped me a great deal. Here's why. In the Caucasus, which is this southern part of Russia, Muslim countries, and Chechnya is a Muslim country, women don't count. Women are not very important. You don't pay attention to a woman. You don't control a woman. You don't ask her for her ID. So, of course, I don't like the fact that women don't count, but in that case, it played in my favor. So it didn't take me a long time to understand that in order to remain discreet, low profile, which is exactly what I wanted, I needed to be dressed exactly the same way as any other woman is, which is basically to have a scarf and a long skirt, to wear a long skirt. You know, the first time I arrived there, it was in September, it was already cold. Of course, I was wearing pants, but I bought especially a long skirt. And then here I am, you know, just a woman among other women. And if I don't speak, it's not obvious, you know, no one can guess who I am, a Westerner and a journalist. And then when I would speak, I speak Russian. They would understand that I'm not Russian, which they were actually, the Chechens, happy to hear, that I'm not a Russian, but I am just, for them, a foreigner. They don't care really who I am, but they care about the fact that I'm a Western journalist, so I can get their story out.
So what is the story of Chechnya? I think really very few people in this country understand what is going on there.
Okay, the story is quite complicated, but to make it simpler, here's a little tiny country in the south of Russia, which wants to become independent. It's Chechen people do speak their own language, Chechen language, which I don't speak, but they also, all of them do speak Russian because they have been scholarized in Russian, and during the totalitarian communist rule, they were obliged to speak only Russian. So at the end of the Soviet Union, when the Soviet Union disappeared, which is in 1991, December 91, a bunch of countries like Chechnya wanted to gain their independence. And Chechnya is among the most aggressive of them. And the first war between Russia and Chechnya was happened several years ago. It was in 1994 until 1996. In 1996, four years ago, they signed a peace agreement. But unfortunately, and I was already there at that time, this peace agreement was not really a peace agreement. It would not settle down. It would not solve any problem. The basic problem is, how do the Chechens and the Russians continue cohabitating, living together peacefully? How is that possible, if it is possible? According to this peace agreement, Chechnya would remain within the Russian Federation, within Russia, but have a certain degree of autonomy. And, for example, Chechnya would elect its own president, which they did. They elected a president in 1997, Aslan Masradov, whom I met quite recently, a few months ago, because he is still in Chechnya. He's still officially the president. But the problem is that he lost completely his influence. Why? Because in between the two wars, so between 96 and 99, what did he do, this president, for the good of the Chechen people? Nothing. And he acknowledged it to me when I asked him this question, actually. So the problem is that why this second war? This second war is the continuation of the first war, actually. There is a certain number of Chechen who want to be independent. They don't want to hear about belonging to Russia. And of course, Russia, the Kremlin, Putin, the new president, they don't want Chechnya to be independent. For several reasons. Because, first of all, there is a lot of oil in Chechnya. And Russia doesn't want to give up on, what this oil benefits could bring to Russia. And also, if Russia gives its independence to Chechnya, then there will be other parts of Russia who want to have the same. So President Putin doesn't want to hear about Chechnya being independent. But as a result, Russian soldiers invaded, entered again for the second time in 5 years, the territory of Chechnya, which is a little territory. It's like half of Switzerland. Yeah. But the difference between this war and the precedent war 5 years ago is that, and that is my feeling because I've been living with those Chechen people for 6 months, the question of independence is not really in their mind anymore. They don't really know what they want. They are lost. It's an identity crisis. And, of course, the people who are caught in between the victims, the 400,000 civilians who don't fight concretely against the Russian, but who are trying to survive under the bombs, they want only one thing, basically, which is this war to stop. And that's exactly what the Kremlin right now doesn't want to hear about. Putin is continuing to say, I don't want any negotiations. I don't want to negotiate with the rebels.
When Putin first came to power, first became president, one of his first acts was to go with his wife to Chechnya
and
give out knives to the Russian soldiers. How did the Chechens feel?
Oh, the Chechens feel awful about that. But this nice thing was more symbolical than very important, because to tell you the truth, the Russian soldiers don't really use their knives, because Russian military strategy during the Second War is the following. It's no contact with the Chechen rebels. Absolutely no contact. They don't go to fight against them. They want to avoid contact at any price because they know that if they fight physically against the Chechen, they will lose this war.
In hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah, exactly, hand-to-hand combat, which is what they did during the first war, and that was their biggest mistake. So they don't want to reiterate this mistake. Okay, so their strategy is bombing from planes and helicopters. It's almost blind bombing. I know I was there. So the Russians lie to the outside world when they say that this war is an anti-terrorist operation and that the purpose of it is only to kill, eradicate only bandits and terrorists. This is untrue, because what they do really concretely on the spot is that they drop bombs on villages where hundreds and hundreds and thousands of civilians live. They don't make a difference between civilians and the so-called bandits and terrorists. And the outside world doesn't know, of course, because there are very, very few witnesses for many reasons. But it's true that for journalists, it's difficult to go and cover this war. For TV crew or radio crew, for example, it's almost impossible. You know, I told you the fact that I'm a woman helped me a great deal. But another reason is also that I'm a print journalist, which is basically that I don't have any piece of technology with me. I only have sheets of paper and my pencil, and I write my articles. And then I have to dictate them by satellite phone to Paris. So that was actually the only piece of sort of techniques I had on myself, which I was obliged actually to wear on my body to hide it. But so the result is what's happening in Chechnya is unknown. People don't know about it, especially here in America, because of the fact that the media coverage was difficult.
We're talking to Anne Nivat, who has been a freelance reporter in Chechnya, one of the few reporters there. She's written the book Chien de Guerre in Paris, which means Hell of a War, and is now in the United States hoping to publish this book in English. What oil companies are there? You know,
actually, in Chechnya, you know, because Chechnya is officially part of Russia, they are not supposed to have to deal with their oil by themselves. You see, they are 100% dependent on Russia, on Moscow. Russia is a federation, and the center of the federation is Moscow. Everything has to go through Moscow. So the oil companies are Russians. You see, it's Russian oil companies. But the thing is that thousands of Chechnya, there is another country which is called Azerbaijan. This country was part of the Soviet Union. Now it's completely an independent state. So Azerbaijan is a foreign country for Russia. And Azerbaijan is is on the Caspian Sea, and the Caspian Sea is full of oil. And in Azerbaijan, you have a bunch of the biggest American and U.S. consortium oil companies, also European companies, because Azerbaijan needs those foreign companies to help, you know, in the oil industry.
Anne Nivat has been our guest. Her book is called Bitch of a War, or Hell of a War. That's in French. It hasn't been translated yet into English. She just won the Albert Londres Prize in France, the highest award in journalism. She is 30 years old. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Visit our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill. We had help today from Deepa Fernandez and Nell Geiser. Our technical director is Errol Maitland, and Matthew Finch engineered today's show. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!